Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. In this episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, so this will be episode 33, we will be going over some more antibiotics. In fact, my plan today is to finish up all the antibacterial agents, and then in a different podcast, we'll begin on the antivirals. So, we've talked about the protein synthesis inhibitors, the cell wall inhibitors, so let's go into the grab bag of other medications that constitute antibacterial. So the first group we'll talk about are the TB meds, so tuberculosis, right? And the big thing you just want to take away is, in general, these drugs are hepatotoxic, and the mnemonic you want to remember is RIPE, the R for rifampin, the I for isoniazid, also called INH, the P for pyrazinamide, and the E for ethambutol. Now, rifampin, its mechanism of action is that it inhibits RNA polymerase. And there are a few other high-yield things you want to know about rifampin. And one thing is that it induces cytochrome P450. So remember, rifampin revs up cytochrome P450. So the classic exam question is a lady on birth control that gets TB, and then she gets pregnant. You want to think about inducing CYP450 and increasing the metabolism of the birth control pill. Rifampin also causes red secretions, right? So, like, you can have, like, red urine, like, red tears, but it's totally fine. You can just go ahead and ignore that. And then it's also part of the drug regimen for leprosy, right? And there's a nice mnemonic to remember that. Just remember DRC, like, Democratic Republic of Congo. So the D for the treatment of leprosy is Dapsone. The R stands for rifampin. And then the C stands for clofazimine. So Dapsone, rifampin, and clofazimine. Rifabutin is it's a rifampin derivative. It doesn't have many of these bad side effects that rifampin has. Now the I, so isoniazid. So the thing is, there is a gene expressed in mycobacterial species. It's called the INHA gene, okay? The protein product of that INHA gene is what is believed to be inhibited by isoniazid. People believe that that INHA gene product is important for the synthesis of mycolic acid. And one other thing with isoniazid is that it's a prodrug, so it needs to be metabolized to the active form by an enzyme known as catalase peroxidase. In fact, that catalase peroxidase is expressed by a protein known as CATG, by a gene known as CATG. So, if you understand that, isoniazid needs to be activated by the CATG gene product, right? So catalase peroxidase to its active form, and it then inhibits the INHA gene product. Then that should tell you that you could potentially have resistance to isoniazid if a person has a mutation in the CATG gene or the INHA gene. Now, another thing about isoniazid, right? If you remember the crack amigos from episode, I believe this was 28, we said that the I there stood for isoniazid, right? So it's an inhibitor of cytochrome P450. Now, this is probably the highest yield thing to know about isoniazid, is that it depletes vitamin B6, okay? So because it depletes vitamin B6, remember B6 is pyridoxal phosphate, you can have some problems with that, right? So one problem you could have is, a person could have is seizures. Because remember, glutamate, if you want to convert glutamate, which is an excitotoxic neurotransmitter, to GABA, which is a more calm down neurotransmitter, you use an enzyme known as glutamate decarboxylase. Glutamate decarboxylase actually uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. So, if you deplete your vitamin B6, you have reduced GABA, and there's an increased risk of seizures. And please don't forget that antibodies against glutamate decarboxylase are associated with type 1 diabetes. Another important thing here is, think about this, right? So, the first step of hemosynthesis, which I believe occurs in the mitochondria, you combine glycine and succinyl-CoA to make aminolevulinic acid. The enzyme that makes that reaction happen is ALA synthase. ALA synthase actually uses B6 as a cofactor. So again, if a person has a depleted B6, ALA synthase doesn't work, and they could have a sideroblastic anemia. So it's a classic side effect with isoniazid, sideroblastic anemia. And isoniazid, also don't forget that it's associated with drug-induced lupus, right? So don't forget your antihistone antibodies. In fact, one nice mnemonic for isoniazid is, just remember the term INH. That's the like the shortened form of isoniazid. The I should tell you that it inhibits cytochrome P450. The N should tell you that it's neurotoxic. It can cause seizures with the mechanism I described before. You can also get a peripheral neuropathy with isoniazid because B6 is a common cofactor in many reactions that take place in neurons. And then the H for hepatotoxicity. Now, the next drug is pyrazinamide, right? So the P, right? So it works well in acidic tissue. The big thing you just want to know about pyrazinamide is the mechanism of resistance is if a person has a mutation in a gene known as PNCA, okay? So PNC like the bank. Now, ethambutol is the E. The big thing you want to know about ethambutol is it causes red-green color blindness. Please go ahead and contrast this with digoxin. Remember, digoxin is one of those cardiac medications. It's a glycoside. It can actually cause a yellow vision. And again, if a patient is being treated for TB, go ahead and supplement vitamin B6, okay? And if a person has latent TB on exams, right, usually the right answer is to give them isoniazid for 9 months as monotherapy. And if a patient has active TB, you want to place them on the RIPE regimen plus vitamin B6. But in general, they take everything in the RIPE regimen for the first 2 months. And then for the last 4 months, you put them on rifampin and isoniazid. And as long as you're on isoniazid, you need to be placed on on vitamin B6. Okay. And last high yield things with TB, right? If a patient has HIV, remember the PPD skin test. You're looking for 5 millimeters or more of induration. That's positive in a patient with HIV. If a person is like a med student or healthcare worker, you want to think about 10 millimeters of induration with the PPD skin test. A person with very few risk factors, like in the US, for example, think more of 15 millimeters. 15 millimeters is positive in everyone. Another high yield group that has a 5 millimeters of induration being positive is a person that's a close contact of a patient with TB. Okay. So the next drug class we'll talk about are the sulfonamides, right? So the thing is bacteria, they make their own folate. And the way they make folate is they convert PABA to dihydrofolate using an enzyme known as dihydroptherate synthetase. And then they go from dihydrofolate to tetrahydrofolate with an enzyme known as dihydrofolate reductase. So the sulfonamides, the way they work is that they inhibit dihydroptherate synthetase. And your dihydrofolate reductase inhibitors, I'll talk about those in a bit, but those include like your pyrimethamine and your trimethoprim. Now, the thing is, sulfonamides alone, they're actually bacteriostatic. But when you combine them with a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor, they then become bactericidal because you're blocking two sequential steps in folate synthesis in bacteria. So, what are some high-yield drug names you want to know here? You want to know about sulfamethoxazole, okay? It's used to treat pneumocystis jervetzi pneumonia in HIV as a part of TMPSMX. The SMX is sulfamethoxazole. Remember your magic CD4 number for prophylaxis, that's 200. And TMPSMX can also be used in toxoprophylaxis in HIV, okay? You generally begin to worry about this when the CD4 count is less than 100. But if you've already covered pneumocystis jervetzi, you've automatically covered Toxoplasma gondii. Now, just an unrelated point, but I think it probably makes sense to include it here. If a person has a CD4 count less than 250 and they live in a susceptible area where they can get coccidiomycosis, remember that shows up as spherules on microscopy, I'll go ahead and give them itraconazole, okay? Itraconazole, it's one of your antifungal meds. And then you also want to give itraconazole to a person that has histoplasmosis, so Histoplasma capsulatum, and they live in a susceptible area if their CD4 count is less than 150. And again, you also make that prophylaxis with itraconazole. And then don't forget that TMPSMX, right? So just another high yield use of sulfamethoxazole. They actually cover Nocardia. Remember, Nocardia is one of those aerobic weakly acid fast organisms. Now, sulfasalazine is another sulfonamide. It's actually used to treat ulcerative colitis. Sulfadiazine is also another sulfonamide. It's actually used to treat toxo. So if mom is pregnant and she gets a toxoplasmosis because she handled like cat litter or whatever, you can actually give pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine. The sulfadiazine part there is a dihydroptherate synthetase inhibitor. And then the pyrimethamine is a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor. Now, remember, these sulfonamides, they have sulfur in their names, right? So they can cause a sulfur allergy. And you also want to go ahead and avoid these drugs in patients with G6PD deficiency. So the classic exam question could be a person from a Mediterranean country. takes one of these sulfonamides, and then they have red urine. Think about a G6PD deficiency in those things, right? Because these sulfonamides, they're powerful oxidizing agents, and they can create a lot of oxidative stress, right? So if a person has oxidative stress and they have like a ton of hydrogen peroxide on board, you want glutathione peroxidase to break down that hydrogen peroxide to water and oxygen. But the thing is, as you're reducing that hydrogen peroxide, that's why it's a redox reaction. As you're reducing hydrogen peroxide, you're oxidizing glutathione. So if you want to regenerate, reduce glutathione, you need an enzyme known as glutathione reductase. And glutathione reductase uses NADPH as a cofactor. So if a person has G6PD deficiency, remember G6PD is the rate-limiting enzyme of the oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway. If a person has a G6PD deficiency, they do not make NADPH, so they have no cofactor for glutathione reductase, so they can get into the oxidative stress can begin to damage their red blood cells. And just as an aside here, remember, a person, N-acetylcysteine is a glutathione analog, basically. So that's how it can really help in dealing with oxidative stress from like bad things like acetaminophen, which is converted to NAPQI, that then basically explodes a person's liver. Now, your sulfonamides, another unusual exam presentation is in the setting of methemoglobinemia. Remember, there are two kinds of iron in hemoglobin. You can have iron in the Fe2+ form, which is the form that can carry oxygen, or iron in the Fe3+ form, which is the form that cannot carry oxygen. So the ferrous form of iron carries oxygen. The ferric form does not carry oxygen. Now, the thing is, sulfonamides, again, because they are powerful oxidizing agents, right? Remember from college chemistry, an increase in oxidation number is oxidation. Excuse me. So, if Fe2+ is going to Fe3+, Fe3+ is basically hemoglobin containing Fe3+ ions is methemoglobin, cannot carry oxygen. So, that induction can be done by sulfonamides, so you can give methylene blue for that, right? Because there is an enzyme known as methemoglobin reductase. It reduces Fe3+ back to Fe2+, and that can help you begin to carry oxygen again. But just as an aside, don't forget that Fe3+ binds cyanide very well, okay? So if a person has cyanide poisoning, you can actually induce a methemoglobinemia by giving ammonitrate. That's another powerful oxidizing agent. It will convert the Fe2+ to Fe3+, and then you give thiosulfate, right, so that you can pop that complex out successfully. So methemoglobinemia is not always bad. Now, another high yield thing with your sulfonamides, right, they can cause kinicterus, right? So if you think about the metabolism of hemoglobin, right, so hemoglobin is broken down first to heme and globin. That's why it's called hemoglobin. And then heme is converted to biliverdin so you convert heme to biliverdin by an enzyme known as heme oxygenase. And then biliverdin is converted to indirect bilirubin or unconjugated bilirubin by an enzyme known as biliverdin reductase. And then that albumin carries the indirect bilirubin. The thing is, if a patient takes a sulfonamide, you actually displace that indirect bilirubin from albumin. And because indirect bilirubin is lipid soluble, it's not water soluble, it's lipid soluble, it can actually cross the blood-brain barrier, deposit in the basal ganglia, and other parts of the brain in general, and it can cause kinicterus. That's why sulfonamides in general are avoided in newborns. Now, trimethoprim, I already mentioned, it inhibits dihydrofolate reductase, so you classically co-administer this with a sulfonamide. Again, it's bacteriostatic as monotherapy, but when you combine it with a sulfonamide, it becomes bactericidal. Now, the thing is, because this drug inhibits dihydrofolate reductase, it can actually cause a bone marrow suppression, just like methotrexate. And remember, you can rescue under those situations with leucovorin. Leucovorin is a folinic acid analog. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is metronidazole, right? So no one really knows how metronidazole works, but we think it generates free radicals. And you want to know the things that metronidazole covers, right? The classic mnemonic you've probably heard a million times is get gap on the metro. So the G is for Giardia, right? Remember, that's a pretty common GI infection, especially in patients with IgA deficiency. If a person goes and drinks water from a stream while they are hiking, think about Giardia with that. The E is for Entamoeba histolytica. Remember, it causes liver abscesses, and you know it's the only protozoal cause of bloody diarrhea, at least that you need to know for exams. The T stands for Trichomonas. Don't forget the frothy green vaginal secretions and strawberry colored cervix. The G stands for Gardnerella vaginalis. Remember the fish odor, pH greater than 4.5. And remember that you see clue cells on microscopy with that. And then the A is for anaerobes, classically anaerobes below the diaphragm. That's why metronidazole is actually used for a lot of GI infections, together with like a fluoroquinolone for gram-negative coverage, like ciprofloxacin. And then the P are for the protozoans. And then also don't forget that metronidazole is actually part of quadruple therapy for H. pylori. Remember MBTP, right? So metronidazole, bismuth, tetracyclines, and a PPI. The M there is for metronidazole. And then you can also use metronidazole for C. diff colitis. Now, the thing is, metronidazole can cause GI upset. Probably won't be tested. It's a pretty common side effect. But it can also cause a disulfiram side effect because it inhibits acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. This is actually not always true. But the thing I'll say is, if a drug has azole in the name, it probably can cause a disulfiram side effect. Because that azole group, I believe, I'll have to do some more research on this, has some role in the inhibition of acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. So that's it with metronidazole. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is colistin. This is occasionally known as polymyxin B and E. These drugs, basically, the way they work is they're like a cationic detergent. So because they're cations, they bind well to gram-negative organisms. They basically turn gram-negative organisms to micelles, and those gram-negatives just disappear. Just sort of think of, if you're a Breaking Bad fan, so it's like Heisenberg style, if you know what I mean. And these drugs are used, again, to treat really bad gram-negative infections, right? They're like last of the last line if carbapenems, for example, are not working for a patient, because there's almost actually no resistance to colistin, although there's been some new resistance reported in the literature fairly recently. Now, these drugs are very nephrotoxic. Many people that take these drugs actually go into renal failure. Okay, so that's it with polymyxin B and E, or aka colistin. So let's talk about the fluoroquinolones. The fluoroquinolones, basically the way they work is they inhibit topoisomerase 2. Another name for topoisomerase 2 you may see on an exam is DNA gyrase. Okay, DNA gyrase. So topoisomerase, right, the thing is it deals with supercoils that crop up as you begin to open up DNA to gain access for transcription, for example. And the thing is, to relieve those supercoils, the thing topoisomerase does is it causes a DNA strand break, it undoes the supercoil, and then it then reanneals the DNA back together. So the thing is, the way these topoisomerase inhibitors work, the fluoroquinolones, they work by inhibiting topoisomerase after it has made the DNA strand break. If DNA, the strand has been broken, and you're like, whoa, you've not fixed that strand break, that can trigger apoptosis in a cell. So that's how the fluoroquinolones actually work as a bactericidal agents, right? Because again, because they cause death of stuff, they cause they are bactericidal. Now, there's a sort of like a weird trend with these fluoroquinolones, right? So if you think about the cephalosporins, I believe I mentioned this in that podcast, but the thing is, the cephalosporins, they actually increase in gram-negative coverage as you go from an earlier generation to a later generation, and they decrease in gram-positive coverage as you go from an earlier generation to a later generation. That's kind of the opposite in fluoroquinolones, although with a small change. So the thing is, the fluoroquinolones from generation 1 to like generations 3 or 4, you actually have better coverage of gram positives. But so generation 1 of the fluoroquinolones, they have like solid gram negative coverage. They have relatively poor gram positive coverage. But if you look at generations 3 and 4, they have very strong gram positive coverage, but they actually do have good gram-negative coverage as well. So don't say, oh, as you go from Gen 1 to Gen 4, you decrease in gram-negative coverage. That's not true. They actually have, Gen 4 has good gram-positive and gram-negative coverage, but Gen 1 has primarily good gram-negative coverage. Doesn't have very good coverage of gram-positives. So some quick high-yield things to know about your fluoroquinolones, right? So like, you know, you need to know drugs like ciprofloxacin, right? Again, covers gram negatives really well. It's a first generation fluoroquinolone. You can also use, it can also be used to treat Pseudomonas. Remember, Pseudomonas is a gram negative organism. Cipro is also pretty good for UTIs, although in general, TMPSMX is used for UTIs, but Cipro is not a bad idea either. But also remember, though, if a pregnant woman has a UTI, you cannot use TMPSMX or fluoroquinolones because they are teratogenic agents, right? In general, in pregnancy, if a lady has like cystitis, you go ahead and give her nitrofurantoin. That's the drug that's classically known as Macrobid. If a lady that's pregnant has pyelonephritis, you usually go for a big gun like ceftriaxone. Remember, ceftriaxone is very good at covering gram negatives, like E. coli, which is the most common cause of UTIs. Now, the second, actually, now that I mentioned that, the most common cause of UTIs is E. coli. What's the second most common cause of UTIs? I hope you're thinking Staph saprophyticus. Okay. Now, some other fluoroquinolones, we have ofloxacin, we have moxifloxacin, we have gadifloxacin. There's only one that does not follow the floxacin mantra. That's nalidixic acid. Nalidixic acid is a fluoroquinolone. I sort of think of it as the ethacrynic acid of the loop diuretics, if you may. Now, again, because as I said, the later generation fluoroquinolones, they cover gram-positives well. That's why, in general, you use the later generation fluoroquinolones to cover community-acquired pneumonia, right? So that's why levofloxacin is used quite commonly for the treatment of community-acquired pneumonia, because it can cover strep pneumonia really well, which is a gram-positive. Now, some side effects of these fluoroquinolones, the big one you want to know is they can deposit in cartilage. So again, you do not give fluoroquinolones to pregnant women so that they don't cause problems with the fetus. Now, another drug I want to talk about is dapsone. It actually has the same mechanism of action as sulfamethoxazole. It's a sulfonamide, so it inhibits dihydropyrrolate synthase. It's a PABA analog, okay? So basically, like when dihydropyrrolate synthase sees dapsone, it's like, whoa, you look a lot like PABA. But it takes on dapsone and then boom, it's inhibited. So the mechanism of resistance, in fact, let me just discuss this as a class. The mechanism of resistance to the sulfonamides are that you can make more PABA to outcompete the sulfonamides, right? So just a kind of competitive inhibition, if you may. Or you can mutate dihydropyrrolate synthase so that it loses the ability to bind dapsone or any other kind of sulfonamide. And again, dapsone is a powerful oxidizing agent, right? So again, you don't want to give this to a person that has G6PD deficiency. Remember the classic histologic findings in G6PD deficiency, right? So like the Heinz bodies and the bite cells. And again, what is dapsone used for? I've already mentioned one use. You can actually use it in the treatment of leprosy. Remember the DRC mantra, right? So the D for dapsone, the R for rifampin, and the C for clofazimine. And then you can actually use dapsone for, so this is one way they can try to get you on exams. You can actually use dapsone for PCP prophylaxis. Remember in PCP prophylaxis, right? So pneumocystis jervetzi, you could use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. That's usually first line. But other options, you could actually use dapsone for that. You could also use another drug known as pentamidine. Usually it's like the aerosolized form. Another thing you could use is tovaquone plus clindamycin. Okay, so very high yield to know the drugs that can be used for PCP prophylaxis. You can use TMPSMX or dapsone or pentamidine or tovaquone plus clindamycin. So just keep those in mind. So I will say with this, we're pretty much done with the antibacterials. So in a different podcast, we'll begin to talk about the antivirals. So I wish you a wonderful Sunday and God bless. See you next time.